Hey folks, if you've been listening to our show, you've probably heard Victor talk about Hillsdale College. It's one of the few colleges in the U.S. still interested in teaching truth. What you probably didn't know is that they have over 40 free online courses. And Victor is one of the professors in three of those courses, American Citizenship and Its Decline, based on Victor's book, The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and globalization are destroying the idea of America, the Second World Wars, based on his book by the same name, and Athens and Sparta, partly based on his book, A War Like No Other, How the Athenians and Spartans Fought the Peloponnesian War. Don't you wish Victor would have been one of your professors in college? Well, now you can join him as he covers some of the main ideas of his books with Hillsdale College's online courses, all available for free. That's right, for free. The courses are 7 to 9 episodes long, and they are self-spaced, so you can take them whenever and wherever. I think I'm going to start with American Citizenship and Its Decline, where Victor explores the history of citizenship in the West and the threats it faces today. Threats like the erosion of the middle class, the disappearance of our borders, the growth of an unaccountable deep state, and the rise of globalist organizations. Hey, start your free course with Victor Davis Hanson today. Go right now to hillsdale.edu/VDH to start. It's free and it's easy to get started. That's hillsdale.edu/VDH to start. hillsdale.edu/VDH.
Welcome to the Victor Davis Hanson Show, The Culturalist, with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Illy Anderson Senior Fellow in Classics and Military History at the Hoover Institution, and the Wayne and Marcia Busk Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. I am the co-host, Sammy Wink. The Culturalist is a new podcast on the relevance of history to modern culture. We often hear it said that the past repeats itself. Here we look at those patterns in history, or some of you have read Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, and he says in that it's a blueprint for all time, and with the idea that that there are certain constants in human nature and human society. Today, in this episode, Victor talks about lessons from ancient Greek civilization found in the Odyssey and in Greek tragedy. Now, first, let's turn then to Victor, the Odyssey, and Homer, who was entertaining young Greeks and teaching them about their mythology. But the ideas of the Odyssey run deeper than myth and an entertaining tale of a journey homeward. And we would like to discuss those other things, those long-term things with you.
Folks, eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages, to help you stay fueled and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. For our listeners, Factor is giving you 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. Use the promo code VICTOR50, that's VICTOR50, at factormeals.com/VICTOR50. Factor Meals eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. That's right. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals. Remember, head to factormeals.com/Victor50 and use the code Victor50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code Victor50 at factormeals.com/Victor50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sammy. So what is Homer? Homer is just a name. There's no first name. There's no last name. There's just Homer or Homeros in Greek. And we associate him with two monumental poems. Monumental means they're long and in they're written or composed orally in a dactylic hexameter meter. Long, short, short, six times. Okay, so we have the Iliad, or about the last year of the war, a multi-week incident, the Wrath of Achilles. And then we have one other poem, the Odyssey, and how one of the heroes, of the many heroes, how they struggle to get back home. In this case, Odysseus, how he came back to Ithaca after 10 years fighting at Troy, and another 10 years wandering the Aegean and the Mediterranean, encountering various monsters. Now, it doesn't mean there wasn't a lot of other Homeric poems. There were dozens of them by Homer and his associates. Oral bards in the so-called Dark Ages between 1200 and 700 BC that composed tales of monumental heroes, monumental places, monumental events before their time. And they passed that down through a guild of illiterates. The writing as we know it, the Phoenician and then the Greek alphabet, did not yet exist when they composed, at least until maybe Homer's last poem or two. So what are the Odyssey and the Iliad, though? I'd like to do a little bit different take. And one of them is, are they historical? Are they accurate? Was there an Ithaca? Was there a Mycenae? Was there a Troy? And that the first thing to remember is that there was a monumental civilization in Greece. We call it the Mycenaeans. And the last stage was the most impressive, about 1600 to 1200, 1250 BC. And the name comes from the greatest citadel at Mycenae. And it was Near Eastern or Egyptian or non-Greek, at least we thought, in its organization. It was monumental. It was on a hill or a rise in the lowlands where a king or a wanox, an onox, and his royal court distributed power, money, authority to people surrounded them. And they brought their wares, their agricultural produce mostly, but also metals up into the royal storehouses. So it was not communistic, but it was very highly hierarchical ranked society. And it fell apart. Crash, burn. We don't know why. We don't know whether it was too intensively controlled by the apparat at Mycenae or Tiryns or Thebes or Glaw, and then they were knocked out suddenly and decapitated. Or we don't know whether sea peoples or the Dorians or somebody from the north came and knocked them out, but they were destroyed. And when they were destroyed, they being Greeks, lost about 90% of their population. So in the detritus that followed for five centuries, just imagine the United States being nuked, if you will, a very complex society being nuked. And we have all these movies about survival on the beach or Waterworld or all of these post-apocalyptic Book of Eli. It's something like that in the Dark Ages. And there were probably Mycenaean lords by the name of Ajax or Achilles or Odysseus. And over the centuries, as this impoverished society recovered slowly, they started telling stories about this last generation or last few generations of the Mycenaean, and they exaggerated them, and they became almost divine. And they stumbled into Mycenaean tombs, Mycenaean walls, and they said, who built these? Who built these incredible things? We couldn't get near doing them now. And so they call them the Cyclops, or the sons of Heracles, or Heracles. So in that process of exaggeration, we had the sack of Troy and the expedition to Troy, and that was probably a Mycenaean raid of some sort into Anatolia from Greece. And then we had the wanderings of one Mycenaean lord, and that became exaggerated into fairyland, so to speak, over four or five centuries. And then the last generation of this guild, that is Homer, he was fortunate that he coincided with the rise of the new city-state. In other words, civilization rebounded, but on very different premises. It was no longer Mycenaean. It was no longer Dark Age. The Greek language is still spoken, but a new alphabet allowed it to be literary. And the city-state arose. And Greek religion was codified. And we started to have epic poems and lyric poems. Hesiod, Works and Days, Hesiod's Theogony, pre-Socratic philosophy. And that last version of that oral saga was canonized or institutionalized or codified, but it was probably written down, and that's why we have it. So to answer our question, what is in the Odyssey? The answer is it's like a sandwich, an onion. One layer, a very small layer, goes back 5 centuries to the Mycenaean world, and there are things in there, certain words of places that no longer existed 500 years and when Homer composed it, and yet they're in the Odyssey and the Iliad. There's a boar, think of it, a tooth of a boar helmet that nobody had ever seen in Greece in 700, and yet it's mentioned in the Iliad. So obviously the poem was handed down father to son or guild partner to guild partner, and they included material objects, they included place names, they included words, they included dialects that nobody knew what they meant. They just knew that it was essential to the archaic flavor of the story. So we can go back and look at those and say, look, there's a Mycenaean boar's tooth helmet, and yet we've dug up one near Argos and we've seen it. So it's historical, but it's very few. So the poem then, the next layer was the Dark Ages. And they're nomadic people, they're horse people, they tend to be aristocratic, tribal, and all of those elements of guest friendship, as Moses Finley, the great classicist, has pointed out in the world of Odysseus, they're all in there too. So the second layer of the Iliad or the Odyssey, or they give us a glimpse into what Greece was like after the apocalypse in the Dark Age. But the final layer is contemporary with the rise of the city-state. And that's why in the Odyssey and in the Iliad, there are references to city-states, there's references to writing, there is references to intensive farming, there is references to cities and places that we know existed fairly recently before the poems were composed around 750 to 700. And I think you could argue that the manner of fighting, it's a very controversial question in phalanxes or phalanges, ranks, represents 750. So where I'm getting at is most of the poems represent Greece at the dawn of Western civilization around 750, albeit you have to pick and choose parts, artifacts from the Mycenaean world in the Dark Ages. This is very windy, but I'll give you an example of what I mean by this. In the 24th book, after Odysseus kills all the suitors, and after they're reconciled, the family is reconstituted, and Penelope and Odysseus are back. They want to know where Laertes, the father of Odysseus, is, and there's a description of his farm. And it's not like a Mycenaean palace, and it's not like a Dark Age horse lord. It's an intensive farmed place in Ithaca. And he has a variety of crops, mostly, as most people did at that time, the Mediterranean triad of vines and olives and grains. It's away from town. People started to live out on their farms so they could intensively farm it more effectively. There seems to be a slave that's attached to Laertes, and we know that chattel slavery was not as it was in Rome, large gangs or in the plantation south, but there was a member of the family that I guess you could, the doulos was more of a household servant, even though he was on free. Remember, slavery in the ancient world has nothing to do with race at all. It's usually the unfortunate circumstances of losing a war. But what I'm getting at is if you look at that farm very carefully, and that's not the purposes of the poet Homer. He doesn't really want to be a historian. He's just saying, you know, he's going to go up to Laertes and he's going to be on a farm. And my gosh, I'll just describe a farm I see in my own time and call it Laertes. But for the historian, it becomes fascinating. It's a fascinating glimpse of what agriculture and intensive agrarianism was around 750 and 700. And then you can take that description in Homer and compare it with archaeological finds or survey field surveys and get archaeological evidence and material evidence to confirm what you see in the poem. So just to finish, the Iliad and the Odyssey are historical documents. The trick is which period, 1600 to 1200, 1200 to 750, or 750 onward to, say, 700, you plug in, and the answer is they're all there, and it becomes sort of a sleuth game to decipher and uncover a particular incident at a particular time. But that's not the purpose of what we study Homer for. We study it for literary purposes mostly, not historical. And within this poem, there are certain, the poems being the Odyssey and the Iliad, there are certain tragic heroes. And we'll get to those in a second. But let me just introduce part two by saying that Aristotle, who looked at Greek tragedy, but also was cognizant of epic, the Homeric epics. What is a tragic hero? It's usually somebody that you excite your pity or your empathy because they're larger than life. This seems very familiar, doesn't it, to contemporary heroes that we have. And you know that they can do things that other people cannot do. And you know they want to do things for the betterment of people other than themselves, like the city or the civilization or the state. But you are aware that they have a tragic flaw. And that tragic flaw, unfortunately, will come out at the most inopportune times. And the tragic flaw is usually one of narcissism or arrogance, because they're so capable. And that will start to undo them. And that will destroy them, even though it doesn't usually destroy the state at large, but it very well can destroy anybody that comes in contact with them. And with that, we'll go to Greek tragedy. How's that, Sammy?
Yeah, that sounds good. Can I ask you one thing, though, that might be a little bit of a digression? But you said Homer saw things, described things that he saw. And I was wondering if you, because I've often heard that Homer was blind.
Yes.
Or so.
I don't want to say saw. I don't want to say saw literally. But remember, when we say Homer, we think that there was a single person who composed the two epics and maybe others. I mean, we have things called the Sack of Troy, the Little Iliad, the Nostoi, the Returns. There wasn't just the Odyssey. There was probably the Returns of Agamemnon or Ajax or Menelaus. And all of these poems together were the product of people that had enormous skills of recitation. And Milman Perry, the great classicist in the 1920s and late 20s and 30s, went to what is now Yugoslavia and found poems of the same length and skill composed by in Serbo-Croatian by oral bards. Not all of them were blind. The point is that in tradition, Homer was blind. Doesn't mean all of the bards were blind, they may have been, but the idea is that in a very physical society, when people had disabilities and could not be productive, how did they support themselves? And one suggestion is that people who were blind cultivated the powers of memory, especially, and they became a guild, and it was a way for people who were blind as bards to make a living. But when I say saw, he was aware, or the people around him were aware, of the material conditions, because he has vivid imagery of metaphors of sunlight, of rivers, of farms. And the suggestion is either he or somebody could see those in their own contemporary time.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. So let's move on then to Greek tragedy. And again, I think we all know that the Greek theater entertained and informed Athenians, much like our television or maybe live streaming today, to be current. It was a medium in which they debated political issues and asked questions about the human condition. And this time you intimated that you'll talk to us a little bit about the tragic hero and its relevance to even our culture.
Yes. And if anybody's interested in the abstract description of a tragic hero, it's all found in Aristotle's Poetics, a 4th century abstract but fascinating analysis of why people feel the way they do when they watch a Greek play, specifically one of the three great tragedians, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. We have 7 of over 100 plays of Aeschylus, 7 of over 100 plays of Sophocles, and for a variety of reasons I can't get into, 19 of Euripides. And in these plays, the trick is that they have a set of themes from epic mythology, which again follows that same pattern. Mycenaean, probably foundations, exaggeration, the Dark Ages, codification with the rise of the city-state, about people and gods that could do things, superhuman things that people in their own time could not. But these were composed in the age of rationalism, between 455, 460, and 400 in the great age of tragedy. And so they take these stock characters. They can't change the story. I mean, they can't change the outline, but each playwright can have a particular take. It's kind of like the old, like a Star Trek TV show. If you take the first Star Trek, which is my generation, you can't kill Spock, you can't kill Captain Kirk. So you know that these people are going to be alive at the end of the hour, but you can make new incidents or stories or outlines within those parameters. And that's what they do. But by that, I mean that they take a character like Heracles or a character like Antigone, and they can't keep her alive because the myth says she's going to die. But each playwright will have a different take on one aspect. If you're an Aeschylean fan and you look at Prometheus Bound, or you look at the Oresteia, there's a sense that these great men of the city-state and Aeschylus's first generation, they had certain cosmic issues. And that is, in the case of Prometheus, how can you help mankind and bring fire to him and yet disobey the rule of the gods? And I don't want to be too technical, but in the city-state, how can people of that aristocratic class still keep customs alive and yet function in a more egalitarian democracy that's more practical and utilitarian? And he tries to resolve these issues in the Oresteia. He has one about a historical incident, the Persians and the suppliants, and especially in the Prometheus Bound. But when we get to the second generation, the Sophoclean tragedies, he's a little different. He's interested in these monumental heroes of the city-state from that class as they can't adopt to democratic complexity, kind of like a George Patton or Curtis LeMay that I've mentioned before. And so they're going to be tragic. They're larger than life. They have super egos, and yet there's no place for a person within egalitarian bureaucratic democratic society. And so to take a couple of examples, there's this monumental character, Ajax. And according to the myth, he's the second greatest warrior at Troy after Achilles. When Achilles is killed, then his divine armor should go to the next best, Ajax. But it doesn't, because Ajax is a one-dimensional heroic figure who would, as he says in the play, I'd live nobly or nobly die. And if he can't perform a task according to his heroic code, then there's no reason doing it. He's not going to change. He's not going to alter his methodology. He's simply going to solve the problem, even though the problem can't be solved anymore under the conditions in which he demands, given the changing circumstances around him. So Odysseus gets the armor because he's smarter in the sense of wilier, more cunning. And Ajax feels that it's terrible. So he gets angry. He rails almost like Donald Trump about the unfairness of society. And then he commits suicide. In the case of Antigone, there's a lot of tragic heroes. She wants to bury her brother who was killed in this civil war. And yet Creon, the king, says you cannot do that because he was a renegade. And she said, but the wills of the gods, and she's this... Again, somebody who's aristocratic overrule those of the city-state. And he says, no, they don't. So you know where they're going to collide. Neither one can give an inch. Each in their own way is majestic, but each in their own way is stubborn and will not compromise. And when they collide, anybody in the immediate vicinity is going to go down with them, as Haman does. And so again, throughout the play, people try to caution Antigone to be moderate, and they do the same to Creon. What's even more fascinating is this third generation tragic hero. That's Euripides in one of his 19 plays, the Bacchae or the Bacchient Women. A king, probably about 15 years old, Pentheus of Thebes, is headstrong. And the way Euripides runs these plays, the first 600 or 700 lines, that's half of the play, you empathize with one character. And then on the second half, you see the other view from the other characters and the protagonist, the antagonist. And then you change your sympathies as the play matures. So in the first half, Pentheus is stubborn. He's a 15-year-old teenager. He's king. And he wants to stamp out this new cult of Dionysus. And he says women in the royal house of the Thebe, including his mother, are going up in the mountains and they're having sex and they're drinking. And it's all under this pretense that Dionysus helps us. He lets us have the benefit of a new gift, wine. And Dionysus comes himself in disguise, incognito. And Pentheus encounters him, and you think, wow, what an uptight guy. I read the play, I think, when I was 18 in UC Santa Cruz, and all the hippie kids in the class said, wow, man, he's uptight, he's repressed, he's a sex monger, but he can't admit it. He's got all these dark desires. Man, he's like our parents or grandparents or like society. And Dionysus is a hippie man. He's got horns or he's got a beard. He likes to drink and party. This is a really great play. And so, of course, it seems that way because Dionysus is sort of, you know, calm. Well, if you want to dress up like one of the women, I can help you go up in the mountains and then you can watch all this bad stuff that's going on. Yes, 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 I'll do that. And he kind of hypnotizes him. The second half, you see Pentheus scouting out the women who are going into these Bacchic rites, and they're sort of singing and shouting and drinking, probably not having sex with men in the shadows, as Pentheus thinks. But Pentheus doesn't know that he's been transmogrified in some dreamlike fantasy into an animal that they're going to kill. And so in the second half, his own mother kills him and beheads him, thinking that he is part of the rite. And then things get interesting because Dionysus becomes sort of the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Yes, Pentheus was arrogant, and yes, he was blasphemous, insulting a god, but shouldn't, as one character said, shouldn't gods be better than men? You have no passion, no compassion. You have no mercy for poor little teenage Pentheus. And so you get the second half. But the point is that in his downfall, it's very tragic because you can see that he meant to do right. You can't run a city with everybody drinking and going up in the mountains. It's just that he had these certain forces that he couldn't control that the god would manipulate. On the other hand, you see Dionysus, and you can't just run a city on pure logic and 24-hour-a-day work schedule. So he's saying to people, you know, lighten up, take time off, have a drink. But he's also a god, and gods can't be questioned. And so you see both sides, and the message tends to be that moderation, but that we have to respect people of an earlier generation or people who are headstrong or people who are talented, even though we give them we can't abide by all of their excesses. We have to understand that we invited them in. Let me just finish by suggesting the way that this works in modern society, I think would be very valuable if we all took time to acknowledge the tragic hero. We see it in, as I've mentioned a lot of times, in real life. There was nobody who was more profane, more obnoxious than George S. Patton, our great commander of the Third Army, in that wonderful, I shouldn't say wonderful, but amazing romp from right outside the Normandy beaches through France all the way near the Rhine River by September 1st, 1944, 50, 60 miles a day. Had he been fueled and supplied, he might have been able to leapfrog over the Rhine and help end the war in 1944. But he had certain flaws, and the flaws were that he wouldn't listen to his superiors, that he knew he was better educated and had a better sense, innate cunning than they did, that when there was all this intrigue about Eisenhower and Bradley and Montgomery and FDR and Churchill, he didn't really care. He just thought that he would be so much more preeminent and superior in his actual performance on the battlefield. Everybody would overlook his supposedly pearl-handled, or I think they were actually ivory-handled. There's a big debate over that. Pistols he wore and his shiny helmet and his magnificent car. But beneath all that, he was a very gifted person. He flew above the battlefield in a private plane, very dangerous. He exposed himself to fire by the enemy. He cared deeply for whether the soldiers of the Third Army, a million people strong, washed their socks so they wouldn't get trench foot. In other words, he was a general's general. He was ideal. He was the GI general, not Omar Bradley. He was the genius, not Bernard Montgomery. He was the organizer and visionary, not Dwight Eisenhower. But he was also uncouth, and he ended up, as you remember, dying in a freak, tragic accident. And then his opponents, his rivals, sort of wrote military history of World War II in Europe for the next 30 years, and he didn't get the due that he was supposed to. And we could go on the same with Civil War heroes. William T. Sherman was uncouth. He was blunt. He was an authentic military genius that ended the Civil War in a way that saved hundreds of thousands of lives earlier than it otherwise would have. Matthew Ridgway was one. Curtis LeMay, we talked about in the firebombing. All of them were not recognized for their achievement in a way that was commiserate with fair assessment. Why? Well, you don't like some guy with a cigar hanging out of his mouth talking like Ajax, or you don't want somebody like Achilles running wild in Korea like Matthew Ridgway, who was just an amazing general. And we see it in our own Westerns, and I mentioned this so many times I don't want to be repetitive, but there is a commonality between John Sturges' Magnificent Seven or Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, or George Stevens' Shane, or High Noon, and that society is in an impasse, whether it's the Federales have squashed the revolutions in the Wild Bunch, or whether the townspeople are being ripped off by the bandits and don't know what to do in the Magnificent Seven, or whether Hadleyville can't really deal with three criminals who are coming back to settle with their sheriff, and they don't want anything to do with violence, and yet they want security. And you can see these dilemmas. A good example is The Searcher. Everybody wants Natalie Wood back. Nobody knows how to get her back except one person, Ethan Edwards. The problem with Ethan Edwards was he probably rode with Quantrell in the Civil War. He's a racist. He's larger than life. He's stubborn, and he wants maybe to kill Natalie Wood, his niece, when he retrieves them. And so all of these characters then are successful, and they solve the problem. They get rid of the Federales. They get rid of Eli Wallach and the Bandidos. They bring Natalie Wood back. They clean up Hadleyville. But then what? Society doesn't want them there. In the case of George Stevens Shane, Shane kills the three cattle barons, the two cattle barons and their hired gun, Jack Palance. But then he says, you know, you can't live with a killing, even if it was a righteous killing, because that's not how civilization's built. So he's basically saying at the end of Shane, I gave you society. I give it back to you. I gave back to law, but I had to do it in an unlawful manner. I had to kill some people, and you can't live with a killing. And I'm also sort of a volatile person. If I stay on this farm, I might end up liking your mother. He didn't say that, but that's what George Stevens is suggesting, because I'm just a loner and I have my own code. It's a heroic code. It's a noble code, but it's not civilization's code entirely. And this all goes back to Greek tragedy in general and Sophocles in particular. These are Ajax, Antigone characters. And it's a very fascinating tragedy to watch them, because they're saying in our own lives, when we look at these people, they do solve problems. And we were the ones that called them in to help us. And yet, once the problem starts to be solved, that they give us the margin of error to be hypercritical and to second guess, and then to blame ourselves for ever bringing in someone. And I'll just finish with the obvious comparison, as I wrote in the case for Trump, with Donald Trump. Donald Trump destroyed the 16-person field in 2015 and 16, the Republican primary. Nobody thought he could do it. He did. Everybody said he was a billionaire, but the fact was he was poorly funded. He didn't raise a lot of money. And everybody said he had no chance against Hillary Clinton. And everybody thought there were certain things that needed to be done. You needed to close the border. And you needed to take on the so-called swamp. And you needed to restore deterrence vis-a-vis North Korea. Or you needed to have an innovative plan in the Middle East. Or you needed to break with this crazy idea that the more largesse and concessions you gave to China, the more democratizing they would become. And yet there was stasis. There was fear. Everybody said, that's not how we operate. That's not what the Council on Foreign Relations suggests. That's not what most Council on Economic Advisors tell us. That's not what the Brookings Institute advises. And so we were having these series of mediocrities in both parties, and they were not solving problems. But the problem with bringing in Donald Trump was, you know, he says things that we recoil at. He tweets things that seem obnoxious. He can't just take on the flawed and kind of disingenuous and actually not very helpful Dr. Fauci. He has to say, have you ever seen Fauci throw a ball? He throws it funny. Why say that? Well, the point is you bought Donald Trump A to Z and you get Donald Trump A to Z. And part of the package to solve the problem, unfortunately, comes with Achilles or Ajax or tragic hero excesses. And those are necessary to cut through the fake news or to take on people who lie about you. But in that process, his own supporters, or at least the people that are swing voters, are going to be turned off, even as the economy reaches historically robust proportions, that unemployment gets to record lows, that energy production reaches record highs, that the Abrams Accord creates calm in the Middle East, that the wall and negotiations with Mexico eventually lead to almost no illegal immigration. And yet, after getting all of those beneficia, the voters say, yeah, but he's not a uniter and he's got certain skills, but those aren't the skills I need any longer because the economy is doing well and these problems are solved. And so that's the plight of the tragic hero. We need them in times of crisis, but we're not able to appreciate the benefits that accrue to us. We only concentrate on the downside of their methods.
Victor, thank you for that discussion of the psychology and the social psychology of the tragic hero. I have a question, though, that is a little bit, once again, of a digression. It seems strange to me that when the Greeks had their tragic hero, like Pentheus, he's killed by his mother, infanticide. But even the modern cultural parallels you're drawing, the searchers, John Wayne doesn't actually kill Natalie Wood. In fact, he embraces her at the end. And in Shane, he rides off into the sunset, and which bodes all, both of those bode well for Donald Trump. But why do the Greeks end their Pentheus in infanticide? Or what's the difference between the cultures?
I think they're a pre-industrial society and we are a therapeutic society and we're American, so we want to have happier Indians. Their tragic heroes suffer from what the Greeks called hubris, that is, Oedipus can't just let it go, that he solved the riddle and got rid of the existential threat to Thebes. But he has to tell everybody that, and he has to be right all along about his birth, and he has to be the sleuth. And they say, if you keep trying to uncover this, essentially you're going to find out you killed your dad and slept with your mom, and that's going to cause mayhem for everybody. But he won't quit. And that hubris then brings in divine nemesis, and that's the anger of the gods for being acting in excess. And then it leads to ate or destruction. And then we have an Aeschylean idea of pathemathos, that only through pain you finally learn. And Oedipus, remember, has a sequel called Oedipus at Colonus, where he's blind and he understands the full magnitude of moderation. So in these Westerns, we don't usually lose the tragic hero, although we do a lot in some war movies, but they don't end up well. So what is Shane going to do at the end? He's obviously been wounded. He's got a limp shoulder and he's riding off up into the mountains and the Grand Tetons. That's not very nice to be by yourself. So we don't know what'll happen to him. And when they're all celebrating in the Searchers and the Sons of the Pioneers, I guess, are playing that wonderful song, he walks out of that John Ford door with a shadow and he's walking in a very strange way. And you know that he's going to be not invited in for a celebratory dinner. He's gone. And remember what Yul Brynner says to Steve McQueen, we lose, we always lose. They'll be glad to see us go. And that there's, so what happened to the track? They all got killed. It's just basically the young follower, he stays in the village. And it's Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen that are the only body left. Everybody's been liquidated. The problem is solved, but at great expense. And they go. And a good example is the man who shot Liberty Valance, where John Wayne then, he makes sure that Jimmy Stewart gets elected and becomes the man of the future and civilization, which he did. He ensured because he killed Liberty Valance. And then what does he do? In typical Ajaxian suicidal fashion, he becomes a drunk, burns down his marriage, beautiful new home that he thought Vera Miles would, you know, flock to and marry him. And then he ends up kind of forgotten. And yet he was the key to the whole civilizing pattern that led to irrigation and agriculture and railroad out west. And so we are Sophocleans in Hollywood and in our own life and in politics, but we're not, you know, we're not Greeks that demand the actual absolute physical destruction of every epic and tragic hero.
And all right,
this is an element just to finish it that comes from, yep, the tragedians are looking at the epic hero in Homer, especially somebody like Achilles, and they know that there's these dilemmas that Homer's outlined and they develop them much more further. The dilemma, remember, in Achilles' tragic situation is that once he sulks in his tent because he wasn't given enough praise and booty given his battlefield exploits, Patroclus, his friend, goes out to take his place in his armor and gets killed, and he could have prevented that. And then he gets angry and he's going to go out and kill Hector, but he is told that he has a choice. He can live long or he can live heroically and die young. And so when he kills Hector, people say to him, there's going to come a time when Paris is going to kill you. And yet he deliberately chooses the suicidal route, that is to die heroically. And all these people know that what they should do when, I mean, how many people, I think I wrote 3 columns, but people more influential than I wrote, maybe 20, Donald Trump, please, please do not tweet anymore. Do not gratuitously attack somebody. Do not make some of somebody the way they look. Just, I know that none of us could endure the pressures that you're under, but you have a magnificent record and you're doing wonderful things for the country and your enemies are flummoxed and yet they're looking for one fatal flaw to exploit. And why are you doing it? And his answer is, I do it because I'm Trump. And Trump does what the hell he wants. And Trump has a methodology. And people elected me because I don't put up with the bullshit and crap. I just get to the quick. And if you don't like it, it's your fault, not mine. I'm a tragic hero. And I'd rather end up badly and be Trump than, you know,
yeah,
than Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi or even people in my own party, Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is not a tragic hero. Mitt Romney's a cat you drop from the third story of a house and he'll land on his feet. Donald Trump will splatter. And then he'll jump off if that's what it takes to solve the problem.
All right. Well, thank you for those discussions of especially individuals, because I find that our country is built on the idea of individualism. And yet we often in history and in culture lose that analysis of the individual and the importance of the individual. So I look forward to future episodes and discussing those types of things.
Yeah, I think we'll do that because we are captives, prisoners of Marxian historiography, where themes and trends class oppression, victims and victimizers, the economy, yep. birth control pills, transistor radios, Silicon Valley make us all, you know, spectators of these historical, these yeah. developments as if we're impotent. We can't do anything about it. Yet the Greeks thought that individuals, Plutarchian people, can say, take away Winston Churchill and where is Britain in World War II? Take away FDR, where is the United States is in that war? So I think next episode of The Culturalist, we'll look at some famous people in history that we don't really give enough attention to. And yet we'll try to imagine what would have happened if this person hadn't have been at this place at this particular time, along with events as well that can change history.
Yeah, that sounds good. And to the listeners, you can find Victor Hansen at victorhansen.com and on Facebook in Meaty Hansen's Morning Cup and on Twitter as well. So all of those places, these episodes will be available and much, much more. And this is Sammy Wink, and we're signing off. Thank you.
Thank you, Sammy.
Hey folks, if you've been listening to our show, you've probably heard Victor talk about Hillsdale College. It's one of the few colleges in the U.S. still interested in teaching truth. What you probably didn't know is that they have over 40 free online courses. And Victor is one of the professors in three of those courses, American Citizenship and Its Decline, based on Victor's book, The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America, The Second World Wars, based on his book by the same name, and Athens and Sparta, partly based on his book, A War Like No Other, How the Athenians and Spartans Fought the Peloponnesian War. Don't you wish Victor would have been one of your professors in college? Well, now you can join him as he covers some of the main ideas of his books with Hillsdale College's online courses, all available for free. That's right, for free. The courses are 7 to 9 episodes long, and they are self-spaced, so you can take them whenever and wherever. I think I'm going to start with American Citizenship and Its Decline, where Victor explores the history of citizenship in the West and the threats it faces today. Threats like the erosion of the middle class, the disappearance of our borders, the growth of an unaccountable deep state, and the rise of globalist organizations. Hey, start your free course with Victor Davis Hansen today. Go right now to hillsdale.edu/VDH to start. It's free and it's easy to get started. That's hillsdale.edu/VDH to start. hillsdale.edu/VDH.